So let's try it again. My name's Dave. Okay, feel free to use it. If we've got any League of Gentlemen fans, we can have a big hello, Dave. You ready then? Good afternoon. Oh, that was quite good. That was good. Okay, I know we're not quite at the start time, but Nigel's got so much to say that we're going to start a little bit early with video. But with it being Nigel, it's a video of him. I'm sorry that you have to come here to massage his ego, but, you know, that's what Green Belt's about for Nigel. Just before we do, some house notices to keep us all safe and happy. If you have a mobile phone that still has charge, please make sure it's silent or turned off. You'll see that no expense has been spared painting wobbly white lines on the floor of our venue. These are walkways that need to be kept clear, so please make sure that you're not sat on a walkway here and a walkway there. If there is an emergency and you need to leave, we will tell you that, but we have four exits. There's the door you came in, there is the actual exit at the back there, and then cunningly disguised fire exits that say no exit are also the fire exits either side of the stage. If you need to leave during the actual talk itself, then can you go out the exit? Don't try and go out of the way you came in. Go out the exit. There is a walkway at the back if you don't want to walk right across the front in front of Nigel. Okay? I think that's about all I need to tell you. Of course, you're here to listen to Nigel Varndell. The reason I've been so cheeky about him is I did actually used to work with him. Well, we worked in the same charity. He saw sense and moved on. I'm still there, but never mind. And it's the Bluffer's Guide to Israel and Palestine. So, Nigel Varndell.
We're not really starting yet. We're just going to show you a little bit of video while people still gather. It occurs to me that many people have no idea what a checkpoint is like. And partly that's because most of you will never have crossed one, and that's partly because it's illegal to film them. Because it's illegal to film them, we thought we'd film them. So this is me walking through the Bethlehem checkpoint. This is from Bethlehem going north to Jerusalem. The woman behind me holding the camera is my girlfriend, Anne, who was literally dangling a video camera by the side of her waist so that she wasn't observed by the Israelis. But I figured if you've never crossed a checkpoint, then you might just want to have a little look at this video just while we're gathering before the seminar really gets going, just to give you some idea of what it's like. This is the walking checkpoint, as the name implies. You do a lot of walking. If you come down to this checkpoint about 4 a.m. in the morning, where I'm walking at the moment is covered entirely with Palestinians who will be asleep there waiting for the checkpoint to open at 5 a.m. About 5 a.m., a lot of them will have permits that mean they can cross it because there's so much traffic going across. Then obviously they want to be there early to get out on time. So they'll camp out there overnight, sleeping on cardboard, waiting for the checkpoint to open, and then they'll go through it. So the first thing you do is walk up that huge long corridor alongside the wall. You go through the gate that I've just gone through. And that really is the start of the checkpoint. We haven't really got anywhere yet. I'm just going to let this run on while you watch it, and I'll make a few comments when we get to interesting bits. And we'll start the seminar properly when on time. Just out of interest, a friend of mine who lives in Bethlehem has back trouble. And at some point she has back trouble that is so bad she can't walk. Now, if you're a Palestinian and you have a medical condition that can't be treated in the territories, what you can do is get permission to go to Israel and get treated in Israeli hospitals. And she got permission to exit from Bethlehem through to Jerusalem to be looked at by an Israeli doctor in an Israeli hospital. As I said, the condition was her back. Her back was so bad so that she couldn't walk. And what they did, of course, was gave her permission to go through this checkpoint. You can't walk. How do you get through the walking checkpoint? This is kind of the absurdities and the bureaucracies of checkpoints. I'd like to see you try getting a wheelchair through those turnstile gates. You can't do it. So this is where you first get to where you're checked in the checkpoint, and you'll see in a minute that I'm joining a queue of a couple of Palestinians who were waiting at that time. I stood there for a long while, so we're going to skip through that little bit of the video in just a second. I'd love to know why the walk is so long. I think it's partly just to make it intimidating. If we just wait for the camera angle to spin around a little bit, you'll see on the gate when we finally pan right. Above the gate, there are two lights, red and green. That lets you know when the gate's open. So you don't interact with people up at this stage. What you get is loudspeakers that give you instructions on what you need to do, and you get lights that turn on and off that tell you where you need to go. But you don't speak to a human. You can see the red and green lights there. The red light's on. Don't go. So if we scroll that forward now, because I was waiting here for about 10, 15 minutes this day. Keep coming. A little bit further. And there. And you go through. And when you get through immediately, what you encounter is a metal detector and an X-ray machine, the kind of thing that you see at airports. And you have to take off everything, your money, your belts, anything metallic, and that goes through the X-ray machine. And you go through a metal detector. And if the metal detector goes off, all of those gates lock again to trap you in there, so you can't move. So if ever you want to know what the inside of an X-ray machine looks like, we're about to put a camera through it, still running. You can find out. It's very, very exciting. Look, it goes black. Still don't know. Don't worry if you're coming in late. We haven't really started yet. We're just warming up. It's a tiny little Canon. It's only about the size of a cigarette box. And it's literally, she was holding it in her hand by her side. But half the time, no, they're not paying any attention. You're not being looked at. So you pick up your stuff. You go through another one of these turnstiles with red-green lights on. This is the one that locks if the metal detector goes off. And you stroll through here. And then finally, you get to the point where you meet a human being and your ID is checked. This actually is about one of the clearest runs we had through while I was living in Bethlehem. A couple of times you could be waiting at that first gate for an hour. Now look at the Palestinian guy that we're about to see. Check out what he's doing with his right hand. Basically, he's being fingerprinted. So if you have a permit to cross this checkpoint, and you can't cross it without a permit, what you will do, you'll come, you'll show your permit, and you'll be fingerprinted before you're let out and before you're let back in. If you're an international like me, you wave your passport, you just get waved through. And that's it. That's all you have to do to get from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. Good day. If you're a tourist, by the way, you will get on a bus and go through a road gate about 100 yards further up the wall, and you will see none of this because no one wants you to see this. If you live in Bethlehem, if you're a Palestinian, that's how you get in and out. Then you hop on the number 4 bus, and you're away to Jerusalem. It happens occasionally, yeah. I've certainly been checked on that bus a few times, and soldiers will get on. Depends how sensitive things are in Jerusalem. If things are particularly bad that time, they'll check you. Right, I think it's time to start now, having had a little diversion just to give you a clue to what's going on. According to a popular urban myth, Pope John Paul II, when asked about peace in the Middle East, said there are only two possible ways of resolving the issue: the pragmatic solution and the miraculous solution. The pragmatic solution involves divine intervention. The miraculous one involves a peace deal. He's probably right. If you've come here, if you feel that about the situation, if you feel it's intractable, if you feel it's irresolvable, if you feel for most of you it's incomprehensible, then you're in the right place. If you feel this is incomprehensible, then this is the seminar for you. I hope what we're going to do is make it slightly more comprehensible in the next hour. Seminar is aimed at people who know nothing or next to nothing about the situation. If it is, as the name implies, a pretty basic introduction. If you have a degree in Middle Eastern politics, you can leave. You're not going to learn anything new here. If you can't tell your West Bank from your Gaza Strip, you're in the right place. My name's Nigel Vandell. I've spent the last 10 years going to the Middle East. Indeed, after Greenbelt last year, I lived in Bethlehem for a while, which is when that video was taken. And in the last 10 years, I've been meeting with Palestinians, with Israelis, Christians, Muslims, Jews, members of the Israeli Knesset, members of the Palestinian Authority, peace activists, terrorists, settlers, soldiers, gunmen, and victims of terror. And what I hope that means is I can give you some insights into what's going on. So what am I going to tell you? Firstly, we're going to do a little bit of geography and some history. It's important to know where some of those towns that appear on your newspapers are. And we're going to find out how these territories came to be occupied and who occupies them and rules them now. Just to note that even history in this part of the world is contested. I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch. If you want to know more, you can follow the arguments of the historians, and they do argue about this stuff. Second thing I want to tell you about is what life is like in the occupied Palestinian territories. The stories you don't get in the newspapers. When you see Obama and peace deals and talks, when you see violence, you get that news. But what I want to tell you about is what it's like for an ordinary human being living in the occupied territories. And if we have time, we'll see how it goes. We might talk a little bit about why I think it matters to you. Final introductory comment is that people always ask for an unbiased account of this conflict. They want the neutral unbiased. And what they mean by that is they want you to give the account they already agree with. Okay? There is no such thing as a neutral unbiased account. I think the only thing you can do in Israel-Palestine is own up to what your biases are. I've worked in the development sector for 10 years. I've grown up working on human rights and development issues. So what I'm concerned about principally is poverty. And poverty in this part of the world is overwhelmingly in the occupied Palestinian territories. Poverty is overwhelmingly a Palestinian issue. So I'm going to tell you very little today about the Israeli experience, and I'm not going to apologize for that. If you want to know about that experience, if you want to know about this conflict, you should and you must go and find out about it. But I can't tell you everything in an hour, and that's what I'm not going to tell you about. It's an important part of the story, and there are other speakers who will be addressing some of that. So do find out. Also need to be clear that the stories I'm telling you about Palestinians, I'm not trying to be pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli, I'm neither. I'm pro-peace, I'm pro-solution, I'm pro-human rights. And I think if human rights for all were respected by all for all, then we would make real progress for all. It's not about being for one side or the other. This could be a win-win situation. So let's do some history. Well, let's start off by looking at what we're talking about. Occupied Palestinian territories today are largely these two areas in the dotted lines. They're the West Bank, and it's called the West Bank because it's on the west bank of the Jordan River. It took me 5 years to work that out. You have a real pro speaking to you today. I'm a genius. And the Gaza Strip, which is that bit down in the bottom of the map around Gaza City. East Jerusalem, obviously, is not featured on this map, but is also occupied. And we could talk about the Golan Heights, but we're not going to because they're occupied from Syria. They're not part of what I'm going to talk about today. Otherwise, we could be here all morning. So let's do a little bit of history. In 1896, a guy called Theodore Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, wrote a book called Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. His argument at the time in that book was that Europe was so anti-Semitic that for the Jewish people to be safe, they, like all other peoples, needed a country. They needed a state. There was much debate about where that state would be, and if you read Der Judenstaat, he talks about Argentina as one possible location for the Jewish state. But ultimately, they became fixated on this land in the east of the Mediterranean, and that was the place where Jews wanted to form a new Jewish state. And what you find is under pressure from European anti-Semitism, immigration accelerates. Jews begin to move into this part of eastern Mediterranean, fleeing persecution in Europe and buying up land from Palestinians, often from absentee Arab landlords. So Zionism starts as a secular movement about the protection of Jewish people. It has a lot of religious dimensions to it today, but that's not how it started. That's not its origins. At the start of the 20th century, during the First World War, there were a series of agreements made, negotiated by the colonial powers that outlined what would happen to this chunk of land after the end of the war. I'm going to tell you about three. First, in 1917, Lord Arthur Balfour, the UK's Foreign Secretary, writes a letter, now known as the Balfour Declaration, to Baron Rothschild, a representative of the Jewish people, and it says, and I quote, that the British government, views with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this objective. Interestingly, the letter goes on to say, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. You don't hear that bit quoted so much. So the first thing we do is promise the land to the Jews. That's the British. Well done us. Second, shortly before this, from 1915 through 1916, there's an exchange of letters that goes on between the Sharif of Mecca, Hussein bin Ali, and Sir Henry McMahon. Now, Henry McMahon's the British High Commissioner in Egypt, and this is about the future political status of the lands under the Ottoman Empire that was an ally of Germany in First World War. The British wanted the Arabs to revolt against the Ottomans and come in on the British side. This is the whole Lawrence of Arabia thing. This is where it started. And in order to encourage them to come in on the British side, Henry McMahon wrote a letter, and it says, as for the regions lying within the proposed frontiers in which Great Britain is free to act without detriment to interests of her ally France, I am authorised to give you the following pledges on behalf of the government of Great Britain, and to reply as follows to your note. Great Britain is prepared to recognise and uphold the independence of the Arabs in the region, lying within the frontiers proposed by the Sharif of Mecca. So the British promised it to the Palestinian Arabs. Excellent. So we've promised it once to the immigrant Jewish community and once to the Palestinian Arabs. So what did we do? Neither. Because we had a third agreement as well. The Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 was a secret agreement made between the governments of the UK and France with the assent of Imperial Russia that defined their respective kind of spheres of influence after the end of the war. The agreement was concluded in May 1916 and negotiated, as the name implies, by the French diplomat François-Georges Picot and Sir Mark Sykes. And that was the agreement we implemented. And what it meant was that Syria and Lebanon became part of the French sphere of influence, and Iraq and Jordan and this part of the world, Israel, Palestine, came under the British mandate. So we promised it to both sides and we kept it to ourselves. Well done, the Brits. We're going to jump now to the aftermath of World War II. Between the wars, there's been a series of events that led the British to believe they could no longer administrate the Mandate Territory. But rather than decide the future of it, they handed the problem over to the UN. So in 1947, the UN approves and votes through a partition plan that divides the area between two states. A future Palestinian state, a future Israeli state, with the area of Jerusalem as an international area, a corpus separatum. The votes passed in the UN by 33 votes to 13, number of abstentions, including the British, and representatives of the soon-to-be state of Israel accept the deal, while the Arabs reject it. And this is the map of the deal. 56% of the land being given to the future state of Israel, that's in green, and the rest being given to the states of the Arabs. Now, at that time, the population of the Jews in the region was probably only about half that of the Arabs, maybe about 600,000 compared to 1.2 million Arabs. But because it was assumed there would be mass Jewish immigration following the Holocaust, the land was divided with a lot of room for expansion for that Israeli community. This plan is never implemented. As soon as it's voted through in November 47, violence begins with Palestinians objecting to the plan. On May the 14th, 1948, one day before the British mandate expires, the new Jewish state named the State of Israel announces its existence with a declaration and is immediately recognized by the United States of America. That declaration is followed by an invasion of the new state by troops from Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, which starts the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, known in Israel as the War of Independence, and by Palestinians as An-Nakba, the catastrophe. That finally ends on the 24th of July 1949 with the signing of an armistice agreement. And if you look at the map at the end of the conflict, it looks a bit like this, and this map will look a little bit familiar. Israel has increased its land area by almost 50% compared with a partition plan, and that 1949 armistice line is the line that begins to set the borders for the Israel-Palestinian conflict of today. The important outcome is that Israel now owns 78% of the territory, as opposed to the 56% they were granted in the UN plan. Jordan controls the West Bank, and Egypt controls Gaza. The other main result of the war was the creation of the Palestinian refugee community, some 700,000 to 750,000 Palestinian refugees, who are now scattered throughout the world and constitute the largest refugee population in the world. That population has grown. There are well over 1.5 million inside the West Bank and Gaza, and another 3 million around the world, about 4.5 million Palestinian refugees. I'm not going to talk about the refugee issue this morning, but that's another key part of this drama. Final date I want to mention, because it sees a change in control of the territories, is 1967. The Six-Day War of June the 5th to the 10th between Israel and Egypt, Jordan and Syria. At the war's end, Israel has gained control of the Sinai Peninsula, which was later returned to Egypt in the late 70s, the Golan Heights, which it takes from Syria, the Gaza Strip, which it takes from Egypt, and the West Bank, which it takes from Jordan. Exactly what caused the war and who was to blame, I'm going to leave up to professional historians, of whom there are a few speaking at Greenbelt. But there are some key points. Tensions in the region build. There are skirmishes between Israel and Syria over access to water. The Egyptian president Nasser, honoring a defense pact he has with Syria, expels the United Nations Emergency Force from the Sinai Peninsula, amasses tanks and troops on the border, and then closed the Straits of Tiran to Israeli-flagged ships. Israel considers this an act of war and launches a preemptive strike, or act of aggression, depending on whose side you want to go with, and wipes out the Arab air forces on the ground. Six-day war happens, and the areas of the West Bank and Gaza Strip come under control of Israel. And we end up with that map that we started with. These are the occupied territories. They've been occupied by Israel since 1967. We're in a situation where we have 43 years of continuous Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. That's the history done. You'll be happy to know there's a whole lot more history out of there, but we don't have all day to talk about it. What I want to do is spend some time thinking about what life is like for Palestinians now. So what is life like in the occupied territories? Let's look at some bald statistics. 49% of people in the West Bank live in income poverty as defined by the UN. 49%. The unemployment rate in the West Bank is currently 25%. 34% of the Palestinian population is defined as food insecure. It means they don't have sufficient access to safe nutrition. That's 1.3 million Palestinians. Why are they so poor? Well, the short answer is the occupation. And what I want to do is look at how that plays out in the West Bank to try and help you understand why occupation means poverty. I want to talk about just two issues. There are a whole host I could discuss, the kind of mechanisms of the occupation, but I'm going to talk about two. And the first I want to talk about is this one, which you may be familiar with. It's the separation barrier around the West Bank. The second is a great deal more important, but we'll come on to that a little bit later. This is the barrier. This is what it looks like for some of its length, not for most of its length, but for some of its length, an 8-meter-high wall, of which there's a mock-up on site. You can see exactly what that looks like in the flesh. In a lot of its area, it actually looks like this. It's fences and military access roads. Those aren't roads for normal cars. Those are roads for Israeli military vehicles. And they're flanked either side by electric fences, motion detectors, and often kind of clear areas that will be filled in with sand so that if people move across them, you can detect the movement after the fact. You can see people have crossed it. And actually, this kind of wall takes up much more land than actually a wall. This part of the barrier is far more destructive because that whole thing can be 80 to 100 meters across that complex. It's very intimidating. What we need to do is look at the map. And that's the clearest route. It's the clearest map I have at the moment. There's some very, very complicated maps on the Beth Salem website that are very, very good. But this is the clearest one I've got to give you a little bit of a hint. And what you'll discover is that the wall doesn't lie on the border between the West Bank and Israel proper. The Israeli government made the decision to build the barrier in 2002. To date, they've built some 413 kilometres of that, and that's out of a total planned route of 709. So they've built about 58% of this. And like I said, it's not on the Green Line. It's not on the border proper. But actually, it cuts deep into the Palestinian territories in the West Bank and cuts off part of the West Bank from the rest of the West Bank. It leaves parts of it on the Israeli side of that barrier. So Palestinian land is on the wrong side. In fact, about 85% of the projected route of the barrier is inside the Green Line, inside Palestinian land. The Israeli human rights organization that I mentioned, Bet Salem, say that about 500,000 Palestinians out of a population of about 2.5 million will be affected by the barrier. 33,000 will actually be enclosed by sections of it with no access to the West Bank, 125,000 surrounded on three sides, and 350,000 affected perhaps by being separated from their land and their family. About 8.5% of the West Bank will end up on the wrong side of the barrier, the Israeli side, and a further 3.5% on the east side will actually be kind of ringed round so that people are trapped. Particularly in the northwest, where there's an area very rich in farming land, you see a variety of impacts. It means that communities might not be able to get to their farming land. They might not be able to get water to their farmland because a lot of wells have ended up on the wrong side of that barrier. They may not be able to get their goods to market across the barrier, even if they can get to their land. And if they do, it may take them so long that that perishable goods, often farm produce, will perish if a soldier denies them access. So that's kind of one impact. The screens are small, so I'm not going to take you through that slide, which is hideously complicated. But I'm going to talk about the impact in Jerusalem as well. These two friends of mine, Johnny and Claire Anastas, who live in the north of Bethlehem. If you've been, you will know Johnny and Claire Anastas, a Christian family. They live just near the site of Rachel's tomb, which is the supposed site of Rachel's burial, Jacob's wife in the Bible. And Rachel's tomb looks like this, or at least it did. That's how it used to look when the tourists could get access to it and tourists would come to the holy site. They'd cross the road to Johnny and Claire's shop and they would shop there for their tourist goods. What it looks like now is this. This is not a brilliant photo, but that house in the middle is Claire and Johnny's house. And if you look on either side of it, the wall goes up either side and actually it joins up round the back of their house. So within 3 meters of their house on three sides, the wall blocks out light from their windows. They're absolutely surrounded, apart from on this fourth side. Their roof has actually been deemed a closed military area, so they're not allowed, without permission, to go on their roof. Now, if you know Palestinian homes, often the water tanks will be up there, so if they have trouble with their water tanks, they need military permission to go up on their roof. If they don't get it, they're obviously vulnerable to being shot at. Now, that gives you kind of some idea of the impact. Claire and Johnny used to run a couple of successful businesses, one of which was a mechanical business and a gift shop. But when the road was built around, obviously no one, when the wall was built around, no one could actually get their vehicles into Johnny's shop anymore, so no one came to have their vehicles repaired there. And what they also discovered was they couldn't get the gear out because the wall had been built so close to his house. So he can't actually relocate his business. So they're really surviving now on people, tourists that go in and buy from Claire's shop, tourist business. And that's the kind of impact it has on ordinary lives. It's not just the family business that's affected. There's a psychological impact to that, particularly on the children. They would like to live in a house where they did have access to their roof. They'd like to live in a house where bullets didn't fly. At various points, Claire has tried to cheer up their family. She tells the story about how she threw a birthday party for her youngest son. 35 people were invited. Only one was brave enough to turn up because it had been a particularly tense time. And her son then asked if he couldn't have, if she would stop making him have birthdays in future because it was too depressing. That's kind of what it means. That's the view out of their children's window. You can peer out of that as long as it's a good day. If the tensions run high, it's slightly more risky. And this is a map. This is quite difficult to see, but, well, I don't know if I can reach out. In the middle, you can see a little white dot surrounded on three sides. Hold on. I'll jog across. That white square is Claire and Johnny's house, and you can see the wall wrapped all the way around it. And that's there to allow Israelis access to Rachel's tomb, which is just a little bit further on, and deny it to anyone else. But you can see this is not a wall on the border. It comes in, cuts chunks out of the West Bank, and surrounds houses. And that's the kind of human impact of it. So, two impacts of the barrier. What I want to talk about is something actually far more pernicious and far more dangerous, which is about settlements. And settlements are far more crucial to Palestinians' lives, but they're largely less well understood. So let's look at those. Ever since 1967 war, Israel has started to move its population onto Gaza and the West Bank. They've now been withdrawn from Gaza, but Jewish Israeli settlements have been built on Palestinian occupied land in the West Bank and Gaza. And they say they were disengaged in August 2005, so it's just a West Bank issue now. Now, under the Fourth Geneva Convention, under international humanitarian law, it is illegal to move any part of an occupying power's population onto occupied land. So all of these settlements under international law are illegal. Need to make that distinction because the Israeli government often talks about illegal settlements. And what it means is settlements that it considers illegal, whereas under international law, they all are. So don't fall for that trick when you're watching Israeli spokespeople on the news. At the end of 2008, the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem, contained 121 settlements that the Interior Ministry recognised as communities, even though some of them contain stretches of land which are not built up, and where there's not contiguous territory. 12 other large settlements and small settlement points are located on land annexed by Israel in 1967 and make up part of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, as opposed to the West Bank. And there are about 100 other additional unrecognized settlements, or these so-called illegal ones that Israel will call them, that are also scattered throughout. By the end of 2008, the number of settlers in the West Bank stood at 479,500. And that figure's based on those living in the West Bank and those living in East Jerusalem. Now, why is that so bad for Palestinians? Well, for security reasons, Israel uses checkpoints to control the movement of Palestinians around the West Bank so that citizens that are living in illegally built settlements won't be threatened. So it's a security measure for Israeli citizens living where they shouldn't be anyway. When you hear about the checkpoints, you kind of get the sense that they're on the border, that they're about controlling Palestinian movement into Israel. But that's not the case. Most of them actually aren't on the Green Line, but they're scattered throughout the West Bank. There are 64 permanent checkpoints within the West Bank, and those permanent checkpoints look a little bit like the video footage we saw at the start. Now, that admittedly is about the worst example you can find. That one and the checkpoint at Ramallah, which is just north of Jerusalem, are particularly bad. But those are the biggest ones, where you have to get a permit to go across, and there will be Israeli soldiers. There are 112 road gates, 66 roadblocks, 162 earth mounds, 11 trenches, 46 barriers, and 20 sets of earth mounds. In addition to that, there's 88 flying checkpoints. And that's a checkpoint that's set up by an Israeli army vehicle that will just stop and block everything on the road and check the permits coming through. That's up from 66, I think, when I gave this talk last year. So the number of flying checkpoints has gone up, but the overall number of barriers in the last year has come down from 541 to 506. So let's just have a little look at what that might look like. So these are the checkpoints, and there are kind of full checkpoints and partial checkpoints. And what we can do is we can plot those on a map of the West Bank. So you can see where they are. They're not on the Green Line. They're scattered throughout the whole of the West Bank to control movement. What we can also do is put on that the trenches, because quite often they'll dig up parts of roads or whatever to stop vehicular transport. So you can still walk across it. There's no reason why you can't do that. But you can't get your car across with your produce for market. And what we can do is we can put the trenches on the map for the West Bank. That particular U-shaped on the right-hand side, that's around Jericho, in case you know. And then we can put the checkpoints back on. And you begin to see we're building up a picture of the restrictions on Palestinian movement around the West Bank. We can put road gates on as well, because that's not the full picture. And you can map those again on top of the already existing permanent checkpoints and trenches, and your map looks like that. But it's a lot worse than that, because what we can now do is put the roadblocks on, and these are huge concrete lumps that are used to block, again, vehicular transport down Palestinian roads. We can put those on those maps, and again, we can begin to build up a picture of what life is like in the West Bank. But it's worse than that, because they also do earth mounds and earth walls. What you'll see, the two women in this picture, what they'll have done is got a taxi up to that earth mound, which will block the road. They'll hop out, climb over the earth mound, and you'll see there's a pile of taxis waiting the other side that they'll hop in and carry on their journey that way. And obviously, if you're trying to take goods to market, you have to do this with back-to-back with lorries. You back them both up to the earth mound and cart the stuff over. And we can plot those on the map as well. And again, you begin to see that the restrictions on movement of Palestinians around the West Bank is pretty severe. We should stick on the wall that we talked about earlier and some of these road barriers. There are roads in the West Bank that are only accessed by Israelis, and in order to protect Israeli traffic on them, they build walls down the side. Now, what that stops, of course, is Palestinians travelling across the other way. So again, they restrict movement. And we can put those two sets of walls on our map as well. Map back in everything we've already put on. And that's the map we get of the West Bank. And then just in case that isn't bad enough, we'll put in purple the Israeli settlements that they're designed to protect. And then we'll put on the closed military areas where Palestinians can't access. Welcome to the West Bank. That's what it looks like. What I want you to do now is imagine what life would be like if you lived there. So what I want you to do is imagine that you can't leave your village unless you have a permit. And if you do have a permit, it will only be at certain times of day. It may be that you're only allowed to leave on foot because the roads are blocked, and maybe only if the soldier that's on the checkpoint is having a good day that day. You probably won't be able to get to school. You might not be able to get to work. You might not be able to farm your fields. You might not be able to get your crops to market. If you can, you probably transport them because actually you only have access by foot and not by a vehicle, so you'd have to carry them. You can't go to university. You can't go to hospital. You can't visit your family. You can't go to church. You can't go to mosque. That's what those restrictions on movement actually mean in reality. You probably don't need me to tell you that all of this is illegal under international law. It's Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Article 12 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, if you need to know. The restriction on freedom of movement, often called closure, caused by the existence of those settlements that are there illegally anyway, is what's ruined the economy of the West Bank. And it's the single biggest issue that impacts Palestinians today. And actually, it's not the only one. But that's what the West Bank is actually like if you live there. I'm going to do a little bit of a gear change and then have a little think about Gaza, because Gaza is very different. Probably remember 27th of December 2008, the Israeli military invasion of Gaza, but we need to see that event not in isolation, but in the context of a continual process that has seen Gaza become more and more isolated and the population more and more victims of a humanitarian disaster that's been politically generated. There are a number of key dates when Israelis have begun to assert greater and greater control of Gaza, and I just want to highlight a few of them. Since before 2000, there were restrictions on Palestinian movement in and out of Gaza. But that got much worse after the Second Intifada started in 2000. Palestinians, many of whom worked in Israel, got employment, were no longer allowed out. So the income they got from jobs was lost. And at that stage, you begin to see a real sharp decline in humanitarian indicators in Gaza. In 2006, after Israel had pulled its settlements out of Gaza, there are a series of changes in the political situation. There's an election that's won by Hamas, who, partly because of international sanctions, form a unity government with Fatah, which was the previous government. That rapidly collapses. Hamas take over Gaza and Fatah take over the West Bank. And that's the kind of situation we have now, with Hamas in political control of Gaza and Fatah running the West Bank. In June 2007, Israel imposed a full blockade on Gaza because Hamas were in charge, and that's seen restrictions on the import of industrial, agricultural, and construction materials, a suspension of all exports, including cash crops like tomatoes and cut flowers, a reduction of the import of industrial fuel, which is used to operate the power plant, which was already running at a reduced capacity due to the damage inflicted by the Israelis who bombed it in 2006, and a ban on the movement of Palestinians through the crossing into Israel, with the exception of extreme humanitarian cases. Which brings us to what we saw erupt in Christmas 2008 and the situation of Gaza today. Prior to the invasion of the Gaza Strip, there had been a ceasefire between Hamas that fires rockets out, mainly at Sderot, the Israeli city just outside, and that had been brokered by Egypt. As the ceasefire was coming to an end, it wasn't renegotiated. The Israelis moved in November, a month before. Hamas fired rockets back. Inevitably, both sides blamed the other for what had happened. Then on the 27th of December, we get that massive military incursion that we saw on our screens. These are some of the photos that were taken immediately afterwards by a friend of mine who went in. This is the Samori family home, that square of rubble. And this is the kind of damage that we saw in the north of the Gaza Strip, not so much in the south, but in the north where the Israelis went in hard. This is the local school in the village of Beit Lahia, Sakunin Elementary School, and again, bomb-damaged elementary school. And these flats are also bomb-damaged in Beit Lahia, a little village in the north of the Gaza Strip. So what does that mean for Gaza today? Let's do some bald statistics again. About 65% of Gazans don't have adequate food. That means they're surviving on world food aid. There's been a change in the diet of Palestinians as well, which is interesting. They can't buy food from outside the strip, and what's happened is their fishing rights have been gradually encroached by Israel. They used to be allowed to fish out to 20 nautical miles. It got lowered to 12, then 6. It's now 3. So the amount of protein in their diet from fish has gone right down, and that means a lot of Gazan children are actually suffering from malnutrition because they have a diet, but the wrong kind. It's not balanced. About 40% of Gaza's workforces are unemployed, and 80% of Gazans are below the poverty line. The damage to the power station that I mentioned before and the lack of fuel means that the majority of the population suffer from power cuts from between 8 to 12 hours a day, and that situation has been getting worse in the last year. They're the lucky ones, of course. The rest have no power at all. You can imagine that has an impact on the storage of perishable foods. It also has an impact on the storage of perishable medicines in hospitals. Now, for a while, the Palestinians had got round that by having generators that are backed up by something called uninterruptible power supplies. But then the Israelis decided that the batteries that run the uninterruptible power supplies were so-called dual-use technology, could be used for weapons, and now the batteries aren't allowed in. So even the hospitals are vulnerable to power cuts. Other sectors of the economy, if you have no power, you can't run sewage plants. What that means at the moment is the Gaza sewage plants pump something like 60 to 80 million litres of raw sewage into the sea every day because it can't treat it. What that also means is that some of that sewage is plumped into holding tanks to be dealt with later. And occasionally, it is very occasionally, those sewage tanks burst and you get occasional tidal waves, literally of shit, running through the streets of Gaza. That's the kind of situation we're in today. Most of the houses won't get running water for more than 5 to 7 hours a day, and only about 5 to 10% of the water they have access to comes above WHO levels anyway. It's unsafe to drink. Healthcare has been undermined. The WHO list of essential drugs is 480 strong. Last time I checked on the UN site about a month ago, 114 of those were out of stock, about 25% of essential drugs not in stock in Gaza. On top of the closure, the thing you need to remember is 3,500 homes were destroyed, 2,800 homes were severely damaged in that incursion, 52,000 homes were lightly damaged, 280 schools and kindergartens were damaged, including 18 facilities that were totally destroyed, and at the moment there is a ban on importing cement into Gaza, so they cannot be rebuilt. And they cannot be rebuilt partly because Israel also bombed the only cement factory in Gaza, so they couldn't make it themselves. So you cannot actually rebuild. Damage to Gaza's infrastructure is estimated at about £1 billion from the military incursion. Last but no mean least, the WHO are estimating that between 20 and 50,000 people will suffer long-term mental health issues as a result of that invasion. Approximately 1% suffer severe acute psychological distress. 13% are currently suffering from sleep problems, 34% report a reduction in appetite and an inability to concentrate, 9% of adults say they can no longer carry out normal everyday tasks like getting dressed, and 23% of children now have bedwetting problems. A while ago, a friend of mine was in Gaza, and I rang him up and said, what happened on the 27th of December? And he said, God forgot Gaza. In the last few months, we've seen attempts by peace activists to bring those humanitarian supplies in. We saw it when the Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, came in, was boarded by Israeli forces, and 9 activists were killed. This is an attempt by peace activists to break the blockade that is killing Palestinians. On the 20th of June, of course, under immense international pressure, Israel announced an easing of the blockade. Well, let's be clear, the blockade was illegal in the first place. Let's not celebrate the fact that it's slightly less illegal. The fact is, you still can't get traffic in. We've seen so far is a 13% increase in traffic of goods into the Strip since the slackening of that blockade. But that still means that we only get a quarter of the traffic that went in before the blockade was tightened in 2007. And as I said, reconstruction materials are still banned anyway. If there's anything, any one thing we can do to help Palestinians at the moment, it's to end the blockade of Gaza. There's a whole pile of other stuff I could say at this point, but I want to leave some time for questions. So what I want to do really is just skip over and say, having probably given you one of the most depressing 45 minutes of your Green Belt experience, why I've done it. And it's tricky. Why actually should you care? Well, if you've seen all of that and don't care, then I despair of you. But frankly, this is a situation that cannot be resolved by the participants in it alone. It will only be resolved if we create, or we help create in the international environment, the political space where this might be solvable. What that means is your politicians, my politicians, are the people who might make this happen, which is why you can have an impact too. It seems a long way away, the issues seem ridiculously complicated, they seem very hard, but I don't think that absolves us of all responsibility. And indeed, if you go round the festival during the course of the next weekend, you will hear talks about what you might do and what you can do. You should visit the Just Peace Stall, you should go into G-Source and see what's going on in there, you should sign up and start making a noise for yourself. It was very interesting. I used to know the man who headed up the UN OCHA, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance, in Jerusalem. And I went to him and said, you know, you have a budget of hundreds of millions, and I'm a single person. What should I be doing? And what he actually said was, you know what, the UN, I can do my job. He says, but the only people that can actually change the political context are civilians, are citizens that are prepared to stand up. So actually, as much as he could do with all of his budget, he said the real hope for any solution to the Palestinian crisis rested on global public opinion and rests on you. So now I've made you feel even worse, because now you have to solve it. Not only is it really bad, but it's your problem. So now we need to come to some conclusion. Let's see if we can do that in a good way. It's an awful situation. Do find out more. You have extraordinary opportunities this weekend. And please get involved. You just might be part of the solution. Thank you.
Thanks very much to Nigel. As you said, there's a chance for some questions. This talk is being recorded, so can I please ask that you wait to ask your question until you've got the microphone, and then people who are listening to this afterwards know what the question was. So we'll start with one over here. Sorry, we'll come to you in a minute.
Is it true that it is now illegal for Jewish members of the Israeli state to cross over into the Palestinian areas, especially Gaza? Illegal. They will be put in jail when they come out again?
Yeah, it's much worse than that. It's slightly more complicated. There is a law on the statute books. When the Oslo Peace Accords were in place, the occupied territories were divided up into areas A, B, and C that had different degrees of control by Israelis and Palestinians. There is a law that states if you are an Israeli citizen, if you hold an Israeli passport, it is illegal for you to enter areas A and B, which are the areas with full Palestinian civil and security control, and the areas with Israeli security and Palestinian civil control. It's illegal for you to do that, and that's applicable for anyone holding an Israeli passport. And the interesting implication of that is what we've done is we've criminalized Palestinians and Israelis talking to each other, because Israelis can't get into the West Bank to meet Palestinians, and Palestinians, for the most part, can't get out to talk to Israelis. So what we've done is created an environment in which case you can never humanize the other. And when you can't humanize the other, then you can kill them a lot easier. And we've made the situation a whole load worse. But yeah, it's true.
It's obviously, as you've said, a very complicated situation and not easy to solve. And often the willingness of the participants to solve it isn't there because they feel so strongly on either side. Now, clearly, what you've told us gives us good reasons to understand why the Palestinians might not be willing to speak peace to the Israelis. But could you give us some idea of how does the Israeli government see the situation? You know, what are the justifications they give for the actions they have taken over a large number of years? Because obviously, you know, if we can understand their point of view as well, that might help us and everybody else to do our bit.
Yeah, national psychotherapy by Greenbelt. This is it's an incredibly challenging question. I mean, the current Israeli government actually is extraordinarily right-wing. Netanyahu is a very right-wing politician who has very little truck with Palestinians and I believe still has a vision for an expansionist Israeli state regardless of what he says to Obama. On his cabinet, he has people like Avigdor Lieberman from Israel Beitenu Party, Israel Our Land Party, which are the kind of Russian party, which are extraordinarily racist. Frankly, just despicable. So the current Israeli government, frankly, has no interest in a peace process. That's what I believe. You can always check out with the ambassador in Britain, who I know, and will tell you something different. But I don't believe they do. The Israeli public, interestingly, there's been a lot of polling data done on the Israeli and Palestinian publics. And if you go and look at it, they tell you some very interesting things. When the Camp David 2 and later Taba peace talks were happening that Clinton brokered, they came to a kind of a rough solution, which is often called the Clinton parameters, if you read all of this stuff. And if you go to the Israeli public opinion and say, do you want peace based on the Clinton parameters, you get figures fairly robust between 65 and 70% will say yes. You get the same figure on the Palestinian side. So the public wants peace. If you then ask them, does your neighbour want the same thing? That figure drops anywhere between 50 and 40%. So they want peace. They don't really believe their neighbour also wants peace. If you then ask them if the other side wants peace, it plummets 5, 10%. So what's public opinion? Is it what people think the public think? Or is it what the public think? And I think what you have is a situation where most people are desperate for peace but are terrified that the other side doesn't want it because of the information they're fed. And it's that terror, I think, and uncertainty that fuels it. And one of the big problems is how do you make everyone feel secure with any peace deal that you might push through? Because if you can do that, then you have some hope. I don't know if that's helpful.
You said in your summing up that the solution is up to us. So thanks for making us really depressed. Another of the seminars later this weekend is time to boycott Israeli goods. Is that a possible solution? What's your stance on that?
Well, if you come along to the session, you'll find out because I'm on the panel. I think I got shoved on late. I think I'm not important enough to go on early in the programme. But I am on that panel. There is a panel, I don't know, because I might skew the whole debate on Monday. I think you can... yes, boycotts, but they need to be very limited, they need to be very clever, and they need to be very targeted. And if you want to know what that means in quite a lot more detail, then do come along on Monday and I'll unpack it. They're an absolutely essential element. They sit alongside pressure applied to companies. That sits alongside European trade legislation. And we need to see that whole kind of boycotts in that wider economic environment, EU trade agreements with Israel, EU trade agreements with the Palestinian authorities. And I think when you begin to add up some very clever targeted boycotts, some economic sanctions, and some business engagement as well, then you might have a campaign that adds up to something that might work.
Over here. Kiwi.
Oh,
down
here. Hey.
Thank you. Thank you for a really, really helpful talk, even without the visuals. I've been imagining it. I just want to know quite simply, do you know what the Israeli government's rationale is for their barrier, their wall, not following the green line? Do they have, what's the party line on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a security issue, and they'll justify it in a number of different ways. But the fundamental answer is security. So there are a lot of settlements that are along that border. So what the wall does is it comes in to include Israeli settlements on the Israeli side of it, so that they're separating them off from Palestinians. And that comes out as a security measure. Now, there's a problem with that, because Beit Salem, the Israeli human rights organization, did an analysis of about four settlements in the north of the West Bank, where they took Israeli military and showed them the maps of the proposed of the settlements and said, if you were seeking a security solution, where would you put the wall? And what you discover is it doesn't seem to follow the most militarily logical route. So their rationale is security, and I'm sure that's part of it. It's absolutely part of it. But in addition to that, there are a whole series of factors which are about grabbing as much land for the expansion of settlements and the best agricultural land and the best aquifers, the best water resources as well. So there's a whole plethora of reasons, but the only one they'll admit to is security.
Hi there. It's my understanding that that Christian Zionism came even before the Jewish, and that I have met probably hundreds of Christians that are so pro-Jewish that they think that the Bible, it's the Bible really, that, that gives them the right to the land and even more borders than what they've got. And they're very, very serious about it, which really means some parts of the church are really not, are causing part of the problem or influencing. What would you say to that?
What I can repeat over a microphone. We can talk more later. Exactly the problem. Yeah, Christian Zionism did precede it. People like one of the Earls of Shaftesbury talks about it even prior to kind of the founding of political Jewish Zionism, and certainly prior to Jewish religious Zionism. And also one word of caution, just on a slight sidetrack, is that when you start talking to any Jews, Jews use the word Zionism in very, very different ways to the way Christians use. So you can often get caught talking cross purposes. But Christian Zionism, the problem with Christian Zionism, of course, if you're going to be really, really crude, and there are many, many flavors of it, some more sophisticated than others, but the really crude version says that in order for Jesus to come again, the prophecies in the Bible must be fulfilled. This political secular entity called Israel is the same entity as that religious community in the Old Testament, based presumably on the evidence that they're spelt the same way. I can't think of any other rationale, but it's convinced me. And therefore, what you have to do is enhance the fulfillment of those prophecies. So what that means when you start unpicking Christian ethics in Christian Zionism is it's not about love your neighbour and do unto others. It's how do I advance the most extreme right-wing political cause of Israel? That becomes the touchstone of Christian ethics. And that's why it's a serious issue for Greenbelt. Because if that's the kind of Christianity you want out there on the street playing to the public about what we believe, then you have a problem. And I have a problem. Because let's face it, it's crap. And we need to get rid of it. Just while we're there, I'd written a little section on Christian Zionism that said that, and I thought I'll leave it out to get questions. But this is Pat Robertson in the States, where the problem is obviously much worse. And just to kind of give people some context that don't know about this, quote from Pat Robertson. I think we need to look at the Bible and the book of Joel. The prophet Joel makes it very clear that God has enmity against those who divide my land. God considers this land to be his. You read the Bible and he says, this is my land. And for any prime minister of Israel who decides he's going to carve it up and give it away, God says, no, this is mine. What Pat Robertson went on to say was that Ariel Sharon was struck down by a stroke because he disengaged from Gaza. And that's the mindset that you get into. That becomes the touchstone of your Christian ethics. And it's just stupid. But it's real, and we have to deal with it.
Hello, yeah. It's very, in your talk, it's very easy, I think, to sort of see the Israeli government and possibly some Israelis as sort of quite villainous and almost, you know, almost oppressive, almost like a South Africa and apartheid. I'm just thinking, what is the best way for us, the international community, to put pressure on Israel to change? Because I think the solution is a two-way thing with Israel and the Palestinians. Without sort of, I think it can be very easy for the Israelis to, for the international to see sort of everyone bullying them and sort of saying you're evil, you're doing something wrong. What is the best way that we can say no? Actually, yes, what you are doing is oppressing the Palestinian people, and there's a better way.
All sorts of things. I mean, I think you're entirely right. And there is, I mean, let's be very clear, there are a huge number of extraordinarily dedicated Israelis who are fighting for Palestinian rights as well. And it's too easy and too glib sometimes to demonize the state of Israel or to demonize Jewish people. So many of my best friends who are peace activists are Jewish. But you're right, the question is, there's this kind of siege mentality. There is, in the psyche, I'll not say who he was, but a very senior Jewish leader was once talking to me about this issue. And he explained this all to me, and I kind of looked dumbfaced at him and said, he said, you think we're all paranoid, don't you? And I kind of went, how do you reply to that question? I kind of went, maybe? And he went, you have no idea how paranoid we are. So the question is, and it's that point, how do we actually make Israelis feel secure with the solution? And the way to do that is not to demonize Israel. I think I'll argue on Monday that it's not to boycott Israel. It's to look for the good bits of Israel and penalize the bad bits. What's the real problem? Settlements are the real problem. Let's go after settlements. And you know what? A lot of the Israeli public has a big problem with settlements because it costs money in their budget to look after people who are often ideological religious zealots from the extreme right of Judaism, who they don't agree with anyway. So you can find common cause with members of the Israeli Jewish community on some issues. But we need to be clear. We're not about, I mean, this is not about ending the state of Israel. This is about a peaceful solution where human rights for all are protected. And we care as much about Israeli human rights as we do about Palestinian human rights. And it's a very hard line to walk, which is why people argue about it all the time. And presumably we're going to argue about it in a panel on Monday.
Yeah, I didn't want to sidetrack from the humanitarian sort of point of view that you're aiming at, but I was kind of wondering what your opinion with regards to the democratic election of Hamas was by Palestinian people and how that was then deemed illegal by the West. Yeah. I kind of thought it was a bit ironic that you're like, they had this whole push to put democracy into the Middle East, and then they elect someone, they're like, no, you can't have them.
And America was funding Fatah, of course, in the election, was giving money to them. The reasons why Hamas won were twofold. Hamas won because Fatah ran a ridiculous campaign. The way the Palestinian Authority is elected is half of it's on a list system and half of it's on a geographical system. So it's a kind of mixed system of elections. And what happened was in the list system, Hamas got about the same vote as Fatah and they got about the same number of seats. But Fatah went into the election really cocky. And they let different Fatah people run against each other in a geographical constituencies up and down the West Bank and Gaza. Whereas Hamas were very disciplined, they put one candidate in. So the Fatah vote geographically was split and Hamas cleaned up. So if you look at who voted for what, the percentages are almost identical, Hamas-Fatah, and Hamas had a landslide victory because they played a clever election strategy. It was a free and fair election, but actually that landslide was based on about a 1% difference in votes. Why did people vote for Hamas? Well, the core vote for Hamas runs about 15-20% of the Palestinian population. That's who actually believe in that more militant, hardline Islamism that Hamas stand for. But what had happened was the one thing that Fatah kept promising was a peace deal, a peace deal, a peace deal. and it never came. And Fatah are hugely corrupt and hugely incompetent. Vast amounts of money was being siphoned off by political officials. And it was a protest vote. So the Palestinians stuck two fingers up to Fatah and said, we'll vote for Hamas as a protest. And that's the government they got. And all of a sudden, America ran scared. And of course, what happened then was the situation became enormously worse because they cut off the money into the Palestinian Authority. And where else do they go and find it? Well, they go to Iran. And you begin to move that movement then even further away from any Western political influence. If we'd encouraged Hamas to come into government, I think they'd have had a very different experience. When you're in power, it's much harder for people to see your flaws. It's much easier, sorry, when you're in power for people to see. So they've come out as the protectors of the people. Actually, I think we could have exposed them and we could have had a much more constructive political dialogue if Hamas had been included in that. Even though a lot of what they stand for, I find really difficult and problematic. And friends of mine who live in Gaza say it's a hard place to live now because of Hamas.
Okay, I know people have got questions. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I would say that Nigel said to me, oh, after I've done the talk in your venue, I'm free all day. So if you've got questions for him, he's got the whole of the rest of the day. Just collar him. Secondly, I've just been out. If you have got questions, I've been handing this piece of paper. There's sessions in the Angels Lounge in G-Source, 2 to 3 every day, where you can ask any questions about this issue that you didn't dare ask here or any other session. So please go there. But before you disappear, let's have a massive, massive round of applause for Nigel. Thank you very much indeed.